This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Turn up the radio and sing along. It's time for another great song. This is the Great Song Podcast.
Season's greetings, everybody out there on the internet. You are here once again with Rob Alley
and JP Mosier.
And you're listening to the Great Song Podcast. We thank you for being with us again this week. We're looking forward to just busting your ears with beautiful juice from the best songs in probably the last 50 years of modern U.S. based
ever
rock pop
ever made
on the lighter end of it ever
made.
So we got a great song for you this week, and we're gonna jump right into it. We've got one of the best, probably, jam band. Is this jam band? Peter
jam band.
Frampton. Do You Feel Like We Do? That is our subject this week. Let us know, what do you think? If you're listening on iTunes or Stitcher or whatever you're listening on, subscribe, give us ratings, comments, all those things that are going to help us be heard by more and more people who are just as nerdy as all of us who are listening to this right now. Let us know what you think. Is Peter Frampton jam band music, or is it just straight rock and roll? Now, granted, Do You Feel Like We Do is 14 minutes long.
14 minutes, yes.
Actually, so...
14 minutes and 15 seconds.
So I think by default, that almost, I mean, it definitely has a long sort of jam section, multiple jam sections. So I guess sort of by default, you go, that's jam band.
But it originally was not a 14-minute song.
It originally was not, and we will get into that later. So let's take a listen real quick. Here is the song of the day, Do You Feel Like We Do by Peter Frampton. Feeling like a key change. Yeah.
According to the prophecy.
let it be done. Okay. All right. I have questions right away.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have questions. 30 seconds into the song, I have a question. Okay. So there's this sort of iconic riff. Okay. The fourth time he plays it, he's just come off a little flourish, right? He's it's a half note difference, a half step difference in the riff. So in other words, he's going, but the fourth time he plays it, he goes, and it's a half step different. And I've wondered my entire adult music listening life if it was a mistake or if he's a genius and did it on purpose.
I guess we could listen to the original and find out.
I don't want to.
Yeah, we do a confession. I do a confession each week. This is not the original, obviously, because it's alive.
This is my confession.
And I have never heard the original from this, but we will touch
Nor
on that.
Nor have I.
Yes.
I didn't know one existed before this. Honestly, until I started researching this, I thought this was Frampton's debut album.
Oh, wow.
I did not know. I thought this was like his like sort of coming out party, because he'd been involved
Humble Pie
prior to this with Humble Pie.
Yep.
And so I thought this was just his like debut. I was wrong. Yep. That's not true at all.
That's correct.
And apparently there is a studio version of Do You Feel Like We Do.
It's off of Frampton's Camel, for those of y'all that are wondering what we were talking about.
Yes.
The original was on Frampton's Camel.
And you've probably never heard it either.
No, I mean, we have not.
This is the only 14-minute song that I know of that gets airplay on, like, classic rock radio. Unless they're playing the entire Dark Side of the Moon album or something like that.
Yeah.
But are there any songs of this length? I know, like, Hey Jude, when it came out, it was a big deal because it was, like, seven minutes long.
And I said, well, the original to this one is, like, 7 minutes and something.
Right, so. Yeah. That's what even the studio version of this is a lengthy song. Yeah. Are there any other, like, just crazy long songs that still get airplay. Any long, Layla, I guess, would be one.
Yeah,
it's,
you know, include the piano outro,
which
if you ever listen to Layla and shut it off before the piano thing, we are no longer friends.
No,
we're done.
That's
the best part of the entire song.
Sacrilege.
Yes.
To not include the piano part of the song. But I heard a radio station do that just a few weeks ago for the first time ever. And I was just enraged, like completely washed over with anger.
And this is why our podcasts that are supposed to be 7 minutes end up being 40 minutes.
Let's
so
not
get
ourselves.
Okay.
This is going to be, I mean, the song itself is 14.
Yeah. So just, if we're going to break down every section.
Just buckle in, everybody. We're going to be here for a minute because we got 14 minutes worth of material just to talk about. So
okay.
Just sit tight, everybody, for a few minutes with us. We're going to really dive into this amazing song. So back to what started this this whole discussion. I'm going to play this again for you, and I want you to give me your opinion just on first listen. I don't know if you've ever taken this into thought.
I have not.
Okay, so tell me if this was on purpose, because musically it fits. It's interesting. It's different. I love it. If it's on purpose, I think it's genius. If it's a mistake, I think, ooh, he got away with one. That could have been bad.
Does he play it again throughout?
He never plays it this way again, as far as I'm aware, through the entire composition. So let's take a listen here.
I'm going to go on purpose because he hits it so confidently.
He hits it very
and
confidently.
Dead on. It's like...
He does.
It wasn't like a slide into, like, I missed it and I'm trying to correct.
See, that's
it was
my only...
so
if he,
confident.
I would have never thought that it was an accident if he had not been playing that little flourish. I'm just thinking about the way myself that I would do it. Like, it would be easier for me to get caught up in the little... side thing I just play and then botch the main riff coming after it. However,
yeah,
this is Peter Frampton.
Sure.
And he is one of the most technically proficient, like, you know, he doesn't make mistakes. Like, he's always so fluid and smooth and is
everything is intentional. I see.
Yeah. He's a theory savant. Like, he's just very, very, very good at what he does. So the chances I think are very good that he did it on purpose.
He managed to put all these weird chords into one song.
Yeah.
So it's got to be intentional.
I think probably it is intentional, which just gives me even more respect for Frampton. I could have maybe there's an interview out there where somebody asked him, hey, was that a mistake? But I don't know of one.
Would that be your question if you get to sit down with Peter Frampton? If
yes.
You get your one question?
If I had one question to ask Peter Frampton, I'd be like, okay, well, at 26 seconds on Do You Feel Like We Do? Then, you know, you're in the Mixolydian mode and you hit that 13 there. Was that a mistake or was that on purpose? And he'd be like, it's on purpose. I'm Frampton. What do you think? Yeah, you think I'd make mistakes? Like, no. Okay. Okay. So immediately this song is just, and here's the other thing I think we have to qualify almost, but I'll get your take on this. This is the Great Song Podcast. Right? You're
correct.
Listening and you are hosting, we are hosting the Great Song Podcast. Is this, in fact, a great song, or are we really talking about a great performance and a great recording?
Yeah, I would have to lean on the, this was a great outing of a song. Like, this is a great live recording of a song. The song in itself, I'm not going to say, is part of the great songs, but the experience of the Frampton Comes Alive side four of this is great.
For those of you who are unfamiliar with Frampton Comes Alive, this was a double live album that came out in 1976.
We're actually looking at right.
We're looking at the LP from JP's home collection. This is referenced in the movie Wayne's World as being issued to anyone who's born in the suburbs.
Apparently I got it for a dollar.
JP got this for a dollar, which is, that's a heck of a buy.
It's a win.
Actually. So this is a long, lengthy album. It is all very good. It includes several tracks that you're still hearing on the radio today, including his version of, Baby, I Love Your Way, which has one of the laziest lyrics I felt like I've ever heard, which is, and he's not the only one to do this, but Ooh, Baby, I Love Your Way.
Every day.
Because it rhymes.
And Show Me the Way is also on here.
That's true. Show Me the Way is going to be the other song that you're still hearing on the radio from this album. But it's very good. And contextually, Do You Feel Like We Do is placed at the end of side four of a double album.
Actually, do you know how the sides are set up on this?
I don't.
Actually, this is kind of cool. I'm going to pull this out and show you. Actually, y'all can't see this, so there's no need for me to pull it out. But sides one and four are together on an album, and sides two and three are together on an album.
Do you think it's for time's sake?
It's mainly for time's sake and flow, and because they wanted, I think they wanted to mix up hits. Like, they didn't want everything on the same album. I'm a big vinyl listener, for those of y'all that are. I have albums that I will only listen to one side of an album because all of the hits are on the one side, and I think they tried to mix it up. And actually, this might be a good segue into how I discovered this song. Actually, my favorite Frampton song is Lines on My Face, which is the song before Do You Feel Like We Do? And that was the song that I would listen to and by default would get led into Do You Feel Like We Do? Because it was the song that followed Lines on My Face, which is my favorite Frampton song.
Interesting. Lines on My Face, of course, being the anthem for oversleeping.
Yeah, that's good. Good call.
So you're listening to, so when you listen to Frampton Comes Alive, do you listen 1, 4, 2, 3?
Or just because of convenience, yes. Okay. Not because I think that's the flow of the concert or the flow of the way you should listen to, but it's just easier for me to flip the record than having to go.
I don't think I would be able to do it. I am still in 2017, and I bet you're with me on this. I'm still in 2017, very much an album listener. I'm an album guy. I don't like to buy pre-orders like on iTunes. I'll buy a pre-order, but I don't listen to the pre-release songs. If they're like, this album comes out in 2 months, but if you buy it now, we'll give you 3 songs off of it for free. I'll buy the pre-order so that I get it the second it's available, but I don't listen to the 3 songs because I want to hear the whole album as a unit. How about you?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah.
I think if I'm listening to Frampton Comes Alive, because I have...
You'll go one, and then you'll go put on two, and then you'll put on three, and then you'll come back and...
Yes, I do that with the George Benson album, double live album, Weekend in L.A., which is laid out the same way. I think just for time to be able to fit some of the longer songs so that's not out of balance and there's enough time on each side, it goes one, I think it's 1, 4, 2, 3, just like that, or 1, 4, something like that. And I'll flip it and put it in the right order, even though it's annoying, but I want to hear it all in sequence the way it was meant to be listened to. It's also because I'm a rule follower. So like if you tell me I'm going to go from song 4 to then song like 13, I can't do it. I'm like, no, this is song 5 for a reason. And I have to, because it says it's 5.
That's awesome.
So yeah. Which is also probably why that note in that riff was so appealing to me, because it's a wonderful little bending of a rule.
It's on a rule riff. Break.
It's a great little rule break. And I admire the guts of Peter Frampton to do it. Let's talk about personnel on this song.
Sure.
Let's meet the band with JP.
Yeah, I love the meet the band section. This is the fun part for me. Bob Mayo plays organ and
guitar.
Bob Mayo on
the keyboards.
Bob Mayo. If you're looking at your box cover or album cover or cassette cover, he's in the bottom left-hand corner here sporting a daunting yellow button-up. About halfway up.
He actually looks like he's kind of trying to win a Peter Frampton lookalike
He is. It's like he's playing an older Strat there of some sort. But he actually plays organ on this song and does the big organ breakdown. Bob Mayo also played with Foreigner and Joe Walsh.
Really?
Uh-huh. Yeah, he played with Joe Walsh for quite a while. He actually died in 2004, which may not seem like an interesting fact until you tie it in with the drummer, John, I think his last name is pronounced Siamos.
Not to be confused with John Stamos.
Very similar names.
Beach Boys.
Also very good hair. Bottom right-hand corner of your album cover. But he also died in 2004.
Uh-oh.
They both died the same year.
What's going on here with Frampton's band?
Other fact about John Siamos, he was also an emergency medical technician.
Interesting.
Nothing to do with music. After, I don't know when in his career, he hung up the drums and went into emergency medical technicianing.
Technicianing.
But that was his thing. And he also played with Carly Simon and Rick Derringer.
Okay. So, Carly Simon and Rick Derringer. Yeah. Okay. What was Rick Derringer's big hit?
It's Hookie, Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo. Is that him?
Is it?
Yeah, I think. Rock and Roll.
I'm thinking of a different one then. He's got something that he He plays it like right.
He plays. Rick Derringer also played in the Edgar Winter. He played with Edgar Winter for a while.
Okay, I'm gonna have to do some next week. I'll be back with more info on Rick Derringer.
Sorry, we did not have more Rick Derringer backing.
I'm sorry, I was unprepared. Segue. I was unprepared on Rick Derringer.
No Andre Agassi fact, but there you go. And bass Stanley Sheldon.
Stanley Sheldon, of course.
Everybody knows Stanley Sheldon.
Everybody's favorite.
Top left hand corner of your album cover. One of the first bass players to ever use a fretless bass.
Really?
Yes, and he is actually playing a fretless bass in this picture.
Yeah,
it's like a Fender P bass, maybe.
Yeah, it looks like a Fender fretless P bass or a Fender P-bass? Jazz.
Maybe.
No, I guess that is
that's
P.
P bass because the two.
Yep.
Combo mm-hmm. there.
And wearing what appears to be like a boxer's robe.
Yeah.
He looks
he
like
he's in Rocky One.
Yeah. He looks like he's about to fight Apollo Creed.
Yeah. Good call.
After,
and a choker.
After
he's
he finishes.
He's wearing a choker.
He's wearing a choker. And no shirt underneath. Just the open boxing robe.
I want you to have a good visualization of the inner album cover.
You kind of need to feel the soft lights and the 70s vibe of this whole thing.
I also have
Frampton on the
CD.
Cover looking like an angel.
And they have the same four pictures on the back of the CD, although the order is rearranged.
There you go.
Would you look at that?
So, and of
that's
course,
that's Meet the Band.
And of course, Frampton on lead guitar and lead vocals.
Playing a Les Paul.
Playing a Gibson Les Paul.
Gibson Les Paul.
Beautifully, as he's done for most of his career.
Original artist who actually wrote the song, because it was not originally wrote here. So the instrumentalist.
Hold up.
That.
Hold up. Are you telling me Peter Frampton didn't write this song?
Yeah, yes, yes. I just mean the people that helped play on the original recording.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yes, all right. Yes. Sorry for the false
I was about to be
false
so shook.
No, he does. Original artist that played on the original album, the aforementioned Frampton's Camel.
Yeah.
Mike Gallagher, who played with The Clash, and Rick Wills, who played also with Foreigner, Skynyrd, and Bad Company.
Yeah.
But they... I guess have I don't know how royalties would work on something like this when the live recording is the one that everybody knows and nobody knows the original, but they played on the original.
If they were listed as songwriters on the original, they would make royalties.
Let's look and see who's listed as songwriters. Shut up, they're listed on here. Wills, Gallagher, Siamos, and Frampton. So darn you, Stanley Sheldon and Bob Mayo for getting thanks for helping out, right?
That's right.
Thanks for coming in and helping out.
Right place, right time, right?
Right place, right.
But it's the other guys who got rich off this because they're making the money off the album sales and the single sales.
Well played, Mike Gallagher.
Well played. Way to be there, Mike.
That was Meet the Band.
Mike Gallagher, no relation to Noel. Liam.
Or the guy that smashes
Gallagher.
The watermelons.
Yeah, as far as we know. No relation there. Okay, so do you have any other technical notes on this song? I know it charted on the Billboard Hot 100. It peaked at number 10 on the Billboard Hot 100 in 1976. It has been covered by Tesla, Night Ranger, who actually combined it with a Beatles cover in the same track. I'm going to have to hear this. I wish I had seen this
Night
beforehand.
Night Ranger was my first concert that I went to.
Really?
Random fact.
Mine was Dokken and Bon Jovi.
Oh, shut up. Similar genre.
Yeah. Night Ranger covered it and did a sort of a mashup with a cover of the Beatles' Tomorrow Never Knows. That'd be interesting. Also, Warren Haynes' notable cover of the song. Let's get into... We know why this song is beloved by everyone else. Why is this song beloved to us? What is great about this song to you?
Well, I did have one other question. I don't know why it's called Do You Feel Like We Do. I feel like it should be called Do You Feel Like I Do.
Yeah.
Except for the fact that they sing we through the talk box section.
Right.
That's the only time I hear him sing we. What's your take on I versus we?
It's one of those, I don't know. Honestly, I have no idea. I almost feel like he should have just called the song Do You Feel?
Oh, yeah.
Or
something completely different.
Yeah.
Like not have the chorus name as the...
What Wine, Whose Wine
could
have been the name of the song. Yeah, I don't know. I've wondered that myself. It's one of those things, but I guess it's maybe geared toward the end. And it kind of maybe is about how, you know, this was their finale. He became well known for... playing the song at the end of his concerts and it very, very much is fueled by crowd involvement and that sort of thing. So maybe we just felt right. I don't know. But maybe, you know, it's just, it feels like a we moment. So maybe he just wanted to go wee. You know?
Sometimes you just gotta go wee.
Sometimes you just go wee. So this song is sort of in three sections. There's sort of the opening rock salvo, and then, you know, you get into the verses and that sort of thing, and then there's a couple of jams, long extended jam section, and then back to sort of the rock, you know, outro, big loud, everything like that. And each section has its own sort of vibe and its own sort of exciting moments that you listen for every time. What's your favorite? Do you have a favorite moment of the song? There's so many.
Probably the talk box section, which is not my favorite section.
Poser.
But it's the
sellout.
Yeah, I know, right? That's probably the because it's the way I know Peter Frampton.
Right.
Like, when I think of Peter Frampton, I think of talk box. Like, that's the way I tie him in, and that's just culturally, I guess, put on me.
Yeah, you and everybody else. Yeah, like, of course.
That's the when I think about Peter Frampton, I think about that.
This was a sort of revolutionary introduction to the mainstream of the talk box. This was the grand coming out, you know, sort of the talk box.
I looked up, man, I wish I'd have wrote this down. There's the guy that actually introduced him to the talk box. I think his last name was Drake or something like that. Not the rapper, yeah. But he actually used to use it on his steel guitar. It was like his steel guitar.
Interesting.
And he would run it through and set it up that way. And
wow.
Yeah, the way it was set up with
that'd be very
the
strange.
Way the mic through it was set up. I don't know. Actually, yeah. It was like a lap steel.
So if you're listening and you're not familiar with the talk box, you will be by the time you've finished the song. But the talk box is basically a guitar effects unit in which you run a tube up with a microphone. It requires a separate microphone. They have digital ones that came years and years later that didn't require the tube. But this one has a microphone and a tube, and it's run separately. And you actually stick the tube in your mouth, in the side of your mouth, and it takes the inflections of your voice by you opening and closing your mouth, and just takes the shape of your mouth combined with the signal that's coming through the microphone, runs it back through your guitar rig and gives the impression, if you do it right, that your guitar is
talking with your guitar.
Yeah.
Richie Sambora also used this a lot.
Yes. Living on a Prayer is one of the classic, wow, wow, wow. Like that riff is, that's a talk box. So this is by far, I think, I say by far, but maybe Living on a Prayer, they could be up neck and neck for most notable talk box appearances.
This was probably the predecessor of big talk box.
Definitely.
Moments.
Absolutely. And talk box is one of those things that, like,
do you ever have a talk box?
I did. I had a digital talk box made by Digitech, and it was tubeless.
Uh-huh.
And it had several sort of iterations of, it had the classic, like, Frampton-ish sound. It had more modern sounds. It got stolen.
I had one, but I actually have feelings and ceilings in the back of my mouth, and my mouth would vibrate weird, some kind of nothing, and it was just awkward for me. So those
terrible.
Of y'all guitar players that have feelings in the back, of all, dental hygiene is important. Second of all, look at the ones that you get, because certain ones will definitely vibrate the back of your mouth.
Interesting.
Talk box is actually one piece of, with the tubing, they wouldn't let me return it because it's for sanitary,
you put your mouth on it
for sanitary reasons.
Mm.
There you go.
So be sure to practice talk box safety out there, all you guitarists. So yeah, this was sort of revolutionary in the rock world. Now, if you're a keyboard player listening out there, you may be familiar with something called a vocoder, which is basically a keyboardist's version of a talk box. Doesn't require a tube, but you have a microphone that plugs into a keyboard, and you've heard bands like, actually sort of the predecessor to it, you had bands like Zapp and Roger, Gap Band, and now you have guys like, what's the guy's name, Byron Chambers, Mr. Talkbox?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is it Byron Chambers?
I saw him and Tim Tebow do a thing together.
Of course you did.
One time.
Yeah.
At Cornerstone Church
Tim Tebow,
in Madison, Tennessee.
Tim Tebow's going to be our underrated songwriter of the week. You,
Mr. Yeah. Talkbox actually opened for a Tim Tebow speaking thing.
Very strange. Well, right. If you ever get a chance to hear Tim Tebow at a coffee shop, you're
check him out. It'll change your life. You'll be donating to
UNICEF.
Before you know it.
Something, I don't know. So anyway, the TalkBox has different applications on keyboard as well, as well as a vocoder that kind of allows you to do the same thing. If you've ever heard California Love by Dre and Tupac, TalkBox is featured prominently in that, but it's with a keyboard instead of a guitar. So anyway, this is the big how do you do for TalkBox recordings.
What is your section?
My favorite section, honestly, is... My favorite section is probably the keyboard solo. It's a weird thing to say.
Bob Mayo?
It's Bob Mayo on the keyboards. Bob Mayo. I just love the... I think it's because in a 14-minute song, it's this lull in the middle. It's bookended by these big rock sections, and it's bookended by this just chill, like jazz-influenced keyboard.
Do you think Frampton? I have not seen the video. Do you think he stayed on stage during that, or did he go take a break, have a drink of water?
I don't know. He might have had to like give himself a face massage, getting ready. Do you have to warm up before you use a talk box? You have to massage your gums. I'm not really sure.
Put on another one of these awesome.
But I think that keyboard solo to me is just so good and so unexpected. Like I just don't. When I think 70s arena rock, I don't think amazing like Wurlitzer solo, you know? But darn if Bob Mayo didn't pull one off.
Well done, Bob.
It's so good. I love it. It's just such a great like catch your breath moment. There's all this excitement with the guitars and then it's headed in immediately to another section of guitar brilliance. But the thing that just really gets me every time, I just find myself bobbing my head, listening to this keyboard solo and like chilled out. Like if I was a smoker, that's your spot. You know what I'm saying? That's where you're like, this is the moment right here for me. But I think honestly, my favorite moment, like that's my favorite section of the song. My favorite moment is he's coming out of the talk box section, going back into just sort of the ending section where it's chords and then a little bit more solo, and he does a big whoa on the talk box that bleeds into his vocal mic.
Can you scan ahead and find that?
And you hear, hold on just a second. Let me find this. Okay, so right there, we're headed out of the talk box section, and he hits the big, it comes off as a chord from the talk box. Well, but you hear his voice coming in harmony over what he's playing over the top. So the guitar is going, and you hear him, and then it kicks into this big jam going into the end. I think that is my absolute favorite moment of the entire song. Just so good. Who thinks to do that? It's another one of those things that could have been an accident. Vocal bleed could have been unintentional. But just such a great moment, such good energy right there. And then of course he just blazes through the rest of the song. The energy at the end of the song when he's hitting the all that stuff is just so good. And especially in context of this is the end of a, you know, roughly hour and 45-minute, 2-hour set.
Yeah.
It's just so amazing. Another interesting just note going back, this was originally not supposed to be part of this album. Did you know that, or were you aware of that?
No.
It was supposed to be a single LP. It was not supposed to be a double album to begin with. And he took the tapes
at a couple of different shows, right? That's what they did.
I believe so. And he took the tapes to an executive at the record company, and the executive said, "Where's the rest of it?" And so at that point, they decided to make Frampton Comes Alive a double LP, and then they chose to include "Do You Feel Like We Do," which is I believe is the most successful single off of it. I mean, if you're top 10 and on the Billboard Hot 100,
I was just looking at all the different places that they took from the show. Winterland and San Fran. Oh, I didn't know that San Fran was a pretty big hub for Humble Pie. Like, that's why they lead with that one. Most of the footage is from there because Humble Pie killed it there.
Who are the other members of Humble Pie?
I do not know.
Was that Steve Winwood? Was he associated with Humble Pie?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so we've got the... our favorite moments of the song, our favorite sections. Is there anything else that stands out to the song about you that you just, one of the reasons that you love it? This is just one of those songs that you never turn off if it comes on the radio. You always turn it up.
I like the key changes early in the song. Yeah. It's tough for me to tell what key the song is in when you go verse, chorus, when you go intro, verse, chorus. If you were just to combine them all in a big pot, I would not know what key to say the song was in, unless maybe D, because the chorus is focused so heavily around D.
Yeah.
You could probably help on that with me. I don't know if you
can. Yeah, it could break it down. I think it would get super boring for the listeners. But I do love, like, he's got just a couple random things like that. There's a couple of random key changing spots. There's one spot in the intro where for no reason they play a bar of like 7/8 time, and where the intro, he's playing that,
and the drummer just changes,
like it just for no reason they leave a beat out, and I don't know if it's a bar of 3/4 time or a bar of 7/8. I'd have to listen to it more closely to pick it out. And they don't do it anywhere else in the song. It's just in this sort of opening thing. And, like, it's amazing. Why would you think to do that? Like, but it's so good. I don't understand why, but just, okay, why not, I guess. Just a little thing that you throw in that, you know, few people are ever going to really care about, probably even pick up on, you know, because they're just there swaying at the end of the concert. You know, nobody really cares. But it's just so cool. One of those little intricacies that makes it so interesting.
Any other random Peter Frampton facts? You have anything like
No,
that?
But I bet you are a fountain of Frampton facts.
I'll cherry pick the good ones.
Frampton is one of your all-time. Where does he rank among your, like, top guitarists of all time?
I'll put him in top 20.
I would have expected more.
Yeah, I'll go 20.
Okay.
Yeah, he's made the poster. He's on my poster. Okay. Top 20.
Who is it? By the way, let the listener understand, JP literally has a poster. Metaphorical.
I made a homemade poster of it's pretty impressive if you ever come over. It's a homemade poster. He went to school with David Bowie. Do you know that?
Did not.
Age 12 to 14, they went to school together, and during their lunch breaks, they would play Buddy Holly songs on their guitar at lunch.
Wow.
Big buddies with David Bowie, and he's a strict vegetarian. So be aware of that when you go to a Peter Frampton concert.
Don't offer him meat.
Don't offer him a Big Mac. He will not be.
Hey, buddy. Peter Frampton, you want to go grab a steak?
And you're a Simpsons fan, right?
I'm an early era Simpsons fan.
Wasn't there a Homer Palooza thing that he was somehow involved in? You might know more about that.
He had an inflatable pig that he had bought at Pink Floyd's garage sale. And the inflatable pig flies away, and his line is, "That's my pig." I actually almost mentioned that earlier in the podcast, and just didn't because I thought nobody cares. Too obscure.
Well, I threw you a pop fly there.
So there, yeah, Frampton, a guest on The Simpsons.
Yeah.
And Frampton would later go on to make the most random guitar infomercial.
Yeah, come here. Yeah.
It was a teaching system, like. Which, honestly, I should have just done it. The guy's amazing. I should have just bought the thing.
He's no Esteban, though.
He's no Esteban. But if you ever get a chance to take a lesson from Peter Frampton, I guess you should do it. I don't know why. I don't know how that did or if it was any success at all. But he's really quite good.
Good guitar player. Peter Frampton.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else we need to cover on Do You Feel Like We Do? If you've never done yourself the favor of listening to the entire 14 minutes in one sitting, please do it. Turn this off. We'll include the link in the description, and you can go on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, probably even, and listen to the song in its entirety. It is really a journey. It's an experience. This thing, just a great piece of
part of the fourth best selling live album of all time.
Fourth best.
I don't know the other three.
Oh,
that's going to be play a guessing game.
Well, I looked up the list of Billboard's like rankings of the best live albums of all time, and I think this was surprisingly low. It was I think it was around number 20, and I thought, really, you're going to put 20 albums? Live like albums ranked? Ahead of Frampton Comes Alive.
Not selling, just not, ranked.
Yes, not some, sales, just their, you know.
And this is as of 2017, so when y'all are listening to this in 2020,
right.
That list could have changed.
Yeah, everybody that's rediscovering the podcast several years from now, going back to the beginning, just be aware this could have changed. But yeah, I was shocked at there was a Cheap Trick, Bob Marley, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 to 20 albums ahead of this on
I can't think of any off the top of my head that I would personally rank ahead of it.
There was a,
with the exception of maybe the Double Live Van Halen Right Here Right Now.
Oh, and see, that was not even on.
That's a personal preference. Or the Dream Theater Live from.
Let's just go through this list. This is the while we have. Well, let's go through the top 20 greatest live albums of all time while we have this, according to.
And let's give it a or a nah.
According to Rolling Stone. All right, and some of these we probably will not even care about. Okay, Frampton Comes Alive. Clocks in on this list. Oh, excuse me. It's lower than I thought, man. Frampton Comes Alive is clocking in on the Billboard 50 greatest live albums of all time at number 41.
What in the world?
So it just barely kind of eked into this list. It's followed immediately at number 40 by B.B. King, Live in Cook County Jail, in 1970. Joni Mitchell, Miles of Isles.
What's number one?
What is number one?
Or at least the top five.
Yeah,
let's do top five.
Scroll down to the top five. Okay, so here we are with the top 10. Nirvana, MTV Unplugged in New York.
No, nothing Nirvana will ever make anyone. No, for you. No.
I will admit, I was not a Nirvana fan. I was a pretty adamant non-Nirvana fan for quite a while. I did really enjoy the live album. Not going to lie. A surprise appearance by the Meat Puppets, which I was a big fan of.
That's one of us. Number four?
That was number 10.
Oh,
number 10. Nine, Bob Dylan, The Bootleg Series, Volume 4, featuring stuff from Royal Albert Hall. Number 8, MC5, Kick Out the Jams.
What is
1969.
That? I'm gonna come over there and look at that picture.
This is the crash bang throttle of the first 10 minutes of the MC5's debut. Made garage rockers of the era sound weak and tentative by comparison. I have literally never heard of MC5. I don't think.
Neither.
I have no idea. Number 7, Grateful Dead, Live/Dead, 1969.
Going to be a Cream album on there?
I don't think in the top 10. Number 6, we've got Alive by Kiss, 1975. Number 5, B.B. King, Live at the Regal. B.B.
King
with
is all over
two
the
albums in the top 20. 50.
Top 20.
I know, I'm sorry. Two albums 50. In the top 40. Yeah, two of the top 40. Number 4, The Who, Live at Leeds from 1970. Number 3, Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison.
Yeah.
I can see one. The argument for that one. It was a very important album, very great album. Number 2, I think if you thought about it for a second, you could probably give me number 2. Of iconic live albums, it's a band. Any thoughts?
Yeah.
Come on, you got it. You're going to kick yourself.
Probably. Have me kick.
Allman Brothers,
oh,
Live
yeah.
at Fillmore
yeah,
East.
Fillmore, yeah.
1971.
I actually have that one. Yeah, that one.
And then according to Rolling Stone, the number one live album of all time, James Brown, Live at the Apollo, 1963. So,
I guess Frampton's... I still would put him in the top five.
I would have guessed he would have blazed into the top five with Frampton Comes Alive.
How can you have the fourth best selling all time and not be in the, I don't know.
It's one of those things about art versus
yeah, I get it. Popularity.
You know, yes, art versus popularity. So, like, you know, I love Batman versus Superman. I thought it was an underrated movie, but I'm in the minority of that. But it might make my top however many, you know, whatever, but.
I understand your argument.
Objectivity.
The people that made that list have not seen Bob Mayo's shirt on the inside of this album cover. That would have definitely jumped up to number 10.
Oh, man. It is kind of a light goldenrod.
Kind of a canary yellow.
I feel like his pants are probably the same color.
It's a pantsuit, yeah.
Or maybe
it's
just
all about
white.
Lighting.
It might just be a jumpsuit, like a...
It's very possible.
Like he's going to do some sanitation
yeah,
work.
Yeah, it is kind of tough to tell where the shirt ends and the pants begin.
It's true. And those are the best kinds of shirts. All right. That's going to wrap it up for this episode of the Great Song Podcast. Thanks for listening. If you're listening on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you are, go rate, subscribe, comment, follow us on Twitter @GreatSongPod. And we will see you next time with another great song on the Great Song Podcast. Bye-bye now.